That's probably the story I think that everybody should probably take away the most from this podcast, is that you want to go into an asset where the demand is high because you have a margin of safety. The demand for small bay is extremely high.
Welcome everybody to Self Storage Income, and I am excited, a little different of a podcast today, just in the terms of topics. We are obviously still talking about self-storage, but we're taking another angle at it. And we're going to be talking about like light industrial, small industrial, bay things, which we have in a lot of our facilities, and storage. So we have storage facilities that literally 40% of it is this. It's either a like-minded or kind of can be very much the same in the same product. So we're going to be talking about that. And with that said, I'm bringing on Shay here, my buddy. How you doing, man?
Life is good. Life is good. Thanks for having me on, AJ.
Yeah, appreciate you coming on. We're going to get into this. Why don't you tell everybody, though, getting started here, a little bit about yourself, and we can go. Obviously, we've known each other for a while, so why don't you walk everybody through your...
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so background on myself. I grew up northwest suburbs of Chicago. I think I was pretty fortunate, pretty lucky. I basically, you know, married my high school sweetheart. We moved to Boston for a little bit. My first career, which I absolutely love, and I think it's a great way to get started, is I actually started selling data storage. So in the storage vein, but this time it was, terabytes instead of self-storage. So I did that for a good long while, but probably like a lot of the listeners, everybody catches a little bit of a rental bug. And what my wife and I, we started to do was we just started house hacking, just kind of one after the next, and got a little bit enamored with it. And then our next investment was we were LPs in a trucking terminal with my now current and mentor and partner, Saul Zenkavich. So we were basically, hey, just put up the money. We have no idea what industrial is, but we're very curious about it. And that's how I got into industrial in the first place. So since then, Saul and I have partnered pretty much exclusively together. And we buy self-storage facilities, but we also buy small bay industrial facilities. And sometimes they're a little bit, like you mentioned, mixed in the same bag on the same property. But that's my background.
And how long have you been doing that?
So I came into self-storage initially, this was probably 4 years ago. Along with a lot of other folks who are probably listening to this podcast.
Got it. Now, what's your current situation look like? Your current assets, your current, that kind of stuff.
So we've had 10 facilities. We've sold 6, currently have 4 storage facilities, then have another few small bay facilities, and then obviously, you know, LP positions in a couple of other handfuls of stuff. But that's what our current square footage is. On my side, my partner, he's got, you know, a couple million square feet. I'm just not involved in every single one of those, but that's good to have a partner like that. You know, you need to have a mentor that, is kind of, you know, can teach you things that we're not to step, we're to step.
100%. That's actually one of the biggest, not only hacks, but avenues that people should go. When you start up, especially when you have partners, things like, what are they bringing to the table? Why are they coming? What are they going to do? And how are they going to do it? A lot of people think that it's just money, and it's actually not. And I was having a discussion this literally before I got on. I was on the phone where I walked in here and walked out. I was having this discussion. So there was a company that was kind of struggling, and they're growing, but they're having some management issues and everything. And they're like, oh, we want you to come buy into the company. We're going to give you equity for it because we want your help and your work and everything else, right? And it's the reason they approached me was not due to the money. The money on the equity, they're like, we can figure that out. It was because we want the expertise, the backing of someone that's already in business and has it, because that's actually where the value comes from, right? And I think a lot of people underestimate that, or they even think that with deal making, you're getting partners, which it's just like, oh, I'm just getting money. That is by far one of the least values that you can actually get from a partnership. And it should be considered. But I mean, if you're starting out, hands down, the most important thing to consider is, with that partnership, what are they bringing to the table that you're going to receive? Because that will pay, like, Shay, for you, obviously you already know, but that'll pay dividends for the rest of your life. That's something that compounds, and that's something that grows you and makes your value more.
Yeah, it's a time machine. You're buying time.
You're buying time. You're cutting out years, maybe even decades. And this is something that to me made sense getting started. And I think a lot of people were like, how did you grow so fast and grow so big? You got all these companies, how are you doing all this and everything? And it's like, we're like, oh, did you go to school for it? You don't learn that kind of stuff at school. That's not right. That's not it. It was I condensed time, and I still do, through the partnerships and the people that I bring in, because you can leverage money. But the most important thing in business to leverage is not money. It is time, knowledge, right, which is in the form of human capital. And that is a condenser that's unlike anything I've seen. And the guy I was talking to, they were like, yeah, that's what they want. We know we need to get from A to Z. We don't want to do it in a million years. We're making all these mistakes. And every time you make a mistake, that costs you not time, that also costs you money. So then your returns go down, everything else. So it's like, bring another person in that they can just say, no, this is do this, this restructure here. And then 5 years, you just cut down. It's a really big deal and one that's vastly underestimated.
Yeah. Is that where you're finding most of your opportunity? Obviously, I mean, everybody who listens to this knows that the market's gone a little sideways the last couple of years. For you, is that where you're finding your biggest potential revenue generators?
It is a big change, and one that we find that is coming a lot to us now. It's opportunities are, we're looking for expertise to help. The market's not great. We're struggling. We're not even sure. Like, when the market's going up, you don't need expertise because the market does it for you. But when the market goes down or sideways, then all of a sudden, if you don't have that expertise, you either fail or you're trying to survive just because you don't have the expertise or knowledge to go through it. There was I was reading Sam Altman, the founder of ChatGPT. He was talking about this. I was reading about this earlier this morning, and he said, the people that survive and the people that grow, he was basically saying business is so hard, right? And it's so hard because you're faced with problems that you don't have answers to. And so every day, that's all business is, right? You know that, we know that. All you're doing is solving problems. You're solving problems for customers, employees, partners, capital, markets. That's all you do is solve problems. If you don't want to have problems, don't go into business. That doesn't make sense because that's what you do. And so when he talked about that, he's like, you really find out that no matter, he said, they could have the best degrees, they could have the most knowledge, experience, everything else. But he's like, if they haven't gone through big problems and downturns and market cycles, he's like, we would never want them or to hire them, because he goes, that's where leaders, and that's where value really comes in, is can they solve those problems? Can they make it through? Can they get there? And experienced business operators, investors, they know that. They know that it's like, you can be successful because of the market, but the first downturn, you're gone, right? You're literally just eliminated, even though you didn't need to be. You could have survived it and been. So that value is big, and that's where we have a lot of people that come to us, including investors. Because they're like, you went through 2008, right? So during times like this, when we may even have investors that they're worried or they're scared and people are ringing out and stuff, we're like, hey, first of all, don't worry, don't calm down. Calm down, it's going to be okay, everybody, right? That's what I'm telling literally on this podcast, that opportunities are rising and the struggles that we're facing, here's how you avoid them. It's why in 2021, we did fixed debt for a decade. It's why we structured the way that we are. It's not because we structured it or did it in a way that we wouldn't have problems. We structured and did it in a way because we knew we would. That's the difference. We know that things won't go according to plan. So we are prepared for that. We realize that, and we know where it might come from. Because then you not only survive, but then you thrive and you get opportunities from it. So I am seeing a lot of opportunities in that realm today where people are just reaching out. They're like, hey, we need this help. We're struggling. The other opportunities are coming from people that are in that situation that haven't been, and they just need to get out, right? They need to liquidate. They need to move. And so most opportunities come when people don't have options. Supply and demand, right? You pay higher prices when you have more options because all of a sudden, or you get higher prices on an asset when you have more options because there's more to choose from. And you die when you don't have options because you're stuck. So this is for everybody listening, you, me, everybody else, that is a general thing. And we're seeing it a lot more now, where even though it's not foreclosures necessarily distress, which I don't know about you, we're not seeing tons of those. Where we are seeing those tends to be in the development side and on the CO deals because they don't have options, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, one of the things that I get a kick out of, and I feel, you know, I feel bad for these guys, but I'll see a broker send out a CO package and it's like, hey, total estimated all-in cost is 8.7 million. Value the facility is like 10.3. And it's like, that's not a lot of gain for an enormous amount of risk, an enormous amount of time.
The price that you pay is always two sides. It is return and risk. Right now, risk actually outweighs return. So if I'm looking at something and it's like, okay, yeah, there's high returns and everything, but the risk is super high. The quality of that return goes down because I can get high returns in today's market without taking on a bunch of risk. So you have those two things that you're working with and opportunity cost. So when you see a development deal like you were just talking about, I'm like, I can go buy an existing cash flowing asset that'll do that. I don't even need the risk, right? So then why pay for it?
Totally. Speaking on the risk segment, I think this is a good way to get into the small bay conversation. So my partner, he's done small bay for the last, I don't know, decade and a half. I started getting into it when the past couple of years where we saw that self-storage is hyper-competitive. Everybody knows this. It's a great asset. And it's hyper-competitive because, you know, it's highly desirable, you know, predictable, and there's growth there. But where we were, we are always attracted to high returns with, you know, associated risk that we can manage. How can we go and find that in an asset class that we know? And where we were finding it was in small bay. So for everybody listening, what small bay is I'm sure you've seen Instagram ads for like a Hamza Invest or like Flex Space, Contractor Garages or something like that. It's all the same thing. It just goes by different terminology. So it's a 1,000 square foot space to, let's call it a 20,000 square foot space. That's 90% warehouse. It's got high ceilings, high doors, maybe an office, a half bath, maybe two baths, depending on the size of it. And who occupies this space are businesses, not B2C, not consumers, like a homeowner. So that's a couple of differences, and we'll get into the differences in between self-storage and this product. But where we saw an opportunity was that there's a lot less risk in small bay because you weren't seeing a dramatic drop in occupancy. The small bay product had a demand that, if anything, has just ramped up over the past 2 years because these services companies are the ones that you are who your tenants are, or an e-commerce company or a small distribution hub. And their demand for space, it's not being, you know, eaten by Amazon. Like, these businesses are growing and they need space, and there's not a lot of that space there. So we saw an opportunity to reduce risk by going into an asset that basically just has high demand.
Well, and this, you know, everybody listens to this podcast knows I've been talking about this asset for 3-4 years. And the driver is that what you just mentioned is really, really important. So when you look at the development cycles that went on after 2008, everything was underdeveloped, right? As it came back, the demand in the markets, lots of it came for industrial warehouse was big. And the reason why demand for that came is bigger space, larger fixed cost, larger premium, bigger tenants that are more qualified. So lower risk, and there can be higher margins, right? So that's why there was so much demand for people to develop that. We can go get one tenant. They're going to occupy this huge amount of space. We're going to make all this money. It's volume. It's more single. They're qualified. These are big companies, right? So the demand, the development cycle that really came in industrial, it was bigger. So you all of a sudden found that we had a gap in the market from this 5,000 to whatever, 25 or 20,000 square feet mark, or less than that, you know, 1,000 square feet, you know, whatever, to that. And that was not being developed nearly at the rates. And the reason being is when you developed it, you had to have more doors, and there's a whole bunch of reasons why. But mainly, you had more tenants, right? So for a developer standpoint, I can find somebody, get one person, I can develop bigger, that's more, I can make more money, single point. It makes sense on a development spread. But that's not the volume of the market, meaning there's way more small businesses that need 20,000 square feet that are in high demand and growing than there are Amazons. And so all of a sudden, the demand for that space was growing due to internet, due to the ability for people to turn things in-house, leave office, do their own shipping, bring supplies in, contractors, all, on and on and on. You mentioned it, or whatever that is. Restriction on land was growing. So the same things that were driving storage was actually driving the space for businesses. But nobody was building it. Where in storage, everybody started developing after 2016, and that really ramped up into 17, 18, 19, right? You did not see a equal development cycle in this space that you're talking about here. So it is, once again, something we've talked about and I've looked at for years. I like the space, not really my thing because on the development side or anything, but I buy storage facilities that have them. So I have probably 200,000 square feet of this product right now that I own and we operate. But the demand, especially in second tier markets, like, I mean, I want to know where you're looking at markets or whatnot. I just know personally, because I don't know a ton about it, but in like my market, local market where I live, if you wanted a space, you had to wait for it to be developed. So if you wanted a space, you literally, people were buying spaces that they would get in 2 years once it was made for them. And so people would go, they'd get the land, they'd zone it, and they were sold out and they hadn't even built anything. And just there was just nothing. So everybody had to wait or you didn't get anything. It was crazy.
I think that that's probably the story that I think that everybody should probably take away the most from this podcast is that you want to go into an asset where the demand is high because you have a margin of safety. The demand for small bay is extremely high. To your point, you can lease something up prior to it even being completed. And how much risk have you taken off the table? So we have our market that we like to go after is Southwest Florida. So Lee County, Collier County, and Charlotte County. So those are, you know, that's Port Charlotte, Fort Myers, Lehigh Acres, and Naples, basically, and Bonita. The space that I'll give you an example about, we bought it. It was 100% full, month-to-month tenants, but it was under market rent. We were able to go in, negotiate with all the tenants in the closing period. Not in due diligence, but in closing period and right after closing period. We never went vacant. We always had a occupancy from a tenant. If they wanted to stay, great. If they didn't want to stay, then we had somebody moving in the next day there. So there's very little vacancy. Obviously, it depends on your market. Real estate's hyper-local, but the demand is extremely high.
Are you a new self-storage investor and want to know what that facility is worth, what the risk is, how to underwrite it? Well, that's exactly what we do in a feasibility study. A feasibility study, we actually look at the market for you. We look at the finances, the underwriting. We show you where the upside is, the downside, and all the risk. That is actually what you can provide to banks to get capital and investors. It's a big worksheet, which most banks actually require. So if you want to know what a storage facility is worth that you're looking at, come to us, follow the link in the show notes, and we will tell you.
Why don't we do this? Why don't you do kind of a comparison, first of all, to the differences in storage, both in, we've talked about some demand stuff. Let's talk about the actual product, how it's set up, leasing, contracts, right? How that works. So the revenue side, where the opportunity comes from in comparison to storage. And then we could talk about the pros and the cons. You want to walk everybody through that?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's first start with the leases. I think that's probably the best thing to start with. Storage, 30 days. Small bay, you're typically looking at, we like 3-year leases. You know, your flavors, whatever, but it's never going to be less than a year. We always do 3 years and above. The lease itself is not a gross lease, it's a triple net lease, meaning you have a base rent and then you have common area expenses. Common area expenses include taxes, insurance, property maintenance. And all those CAM expenses or common area expenses get passed along to the tenant. So your base rent, you have a very clear number on what your NOI is. Your base rent times 12 months is your NOI. All other expenses get passed along to your tenant. So you know what the value of the property is extremely transparently based on that. Now, from a management perspective, similar and a little bit different. I think let's just talk about like a life cycle of an asset. So from the beginning of a customer acquisition in an asset, it's very hands-on to get that customer. Lease negotiations are most likely either happening between a broker and the tenant or owner and the tenant. And that's, you know, myself. I do pretty much all the lease negotiations. We have a VA team that does some, but these are high value leases. Each lease is probably worth, I don't know, a few hundred thousand bucks on a cap rate. So you want to, it's worth your time to pay attention to. At the beginning, you're negotiating the leases, then you're doing certificates of occupancy. Maybe you are doing some tenant improvements. So there is a, I would say, a much higher touch and a much greater degree of, like, let's say, focus on the beginning of the lease and the interaction with the tenant. Now, once they're in, it's a triple net lease. Everything inside that box that they're renting is their responsibility. You're responsible for the envelope of the building. A leak happens in the roof, that's on you. But if something happens to a plumbing fixture, that's on the tenant. So high touch in the beginning, low touch very much afterwards. From an ongoing call basis, we're all very familiar with storage being kind of like a step down from hotels. Like hotels is probably the highest touch, highest turnover, right? Nightly rates. Self-storage, you get maybe they're in a month, out the next month. Our call volume is probably, I would say it's at minimum 90% less than what it is on our storage side. So just from a management perspective, beginning of the lease, hyper involved from the landlord's perspective. Then on, really, there's not much interaction and or involvement from the landlord and the tenant.
When you look at, you know, one of the big things with storage is kind of the RevMan side, right? So walk us through when you look at these, I guess for me, we talk a lot about the strategy in storage. What do you view as the strategy? Is it development or is it like, what is your strategy and what should be a strategy? What are the strategies available here?
Okay. So let's just be very clear. You have one opportunity to negotiate the lease and the rent bumps in the lease, and that's at the beginning of the lease. So you don't have the opportunity to do revenue management in small bay. Like you can't buy Veritech or ProRise or something like that and like inch everybody's rates up. That doesn't exist. They are locked into that lease and so are you. So take that off the table. That's a downside of small bay, is that you don't have the opportunity to implement revenue management. However, the strategy that we have for maximizing value is that, much like an old real estate saying is, you make your money on the buy. That's totally there with this asset class. What do I mean by that? Okay, let's like a real deal example. We bought a deal it was doing 242 on its gross income. What we were able to do, go in there, renegotiate everything, probably 50% new tenants into there. And now our NOI is at 370 for that asset. You're making your money on the spread, and the strategy is to make your money on the rent increase of placing a new tenant. That's really the strategy. Now, of course, you can develop. If you can rent something at $12 triple net, really anything below $120, you're going to be above a 10 cap on basis. So which means you're going to be cash flowing pretty well. I have not developed anything out of the ground on these deals. I strictly go for a value add, where I find deals that have month-to-month tenants in them or leases expiring in the near future. And I want to renegotiate those leases or replace tenants at new market rates. That's the strategy where you're able to really make your money.
Which actually makes sense. It's funny because that is like storage. It's just you set it in place, right? So it's like the same strategy on negotiations, turning over tenants, getting the right tenants in, the high paid. It's just a one-shot thing, right? So you're coming in and then you're doing that until obviously the next lease turns over in the 3 years. But it's almost to me like you're condensing that into the acquisition, not the acquisition and then do that and optimize so much. It's like this is just part of that right out of the gate. We're doing it and then we get it all and it's kind of set. Meaning obviously you're going to do it when you can over the next few months, but storage, that may be 3 years that we do that revenue optimization and tenants, everything else, where it's like you're doing it first 6 months, right? And then it's set for the next 3 years.
If you can buy a property that has month-to-month leases and you go renegotiate them, that's ideal right away. Or you just, your opportunity is when the lease expiration is and to bring it up to market rate. To your point, it's the kind of that's your window of value add that you have.
Tell me about this industry. Like in storage, we're like, okay, there's 60,000 storage facilities. There's mom and pops. There's industrial. Walk us through the landscape then that you're operating, because what you mentioned is there's ones that do month to month, and obviously there's ones not. There's small bay. There's medium, large. Like, what does that look like? Like, what is this playing field look like?
There's really not a lot of brands, and there's no like extra space. There are private equity firms that own large sums of these and large square footage of these. Like, so for example, I think Blackstone in 2022, they purchased, I think PS Business Parks was the name of the business. And it's all small bay. Everything's, I think, below 30,000 square feet or so per unit. And that's a little less than 1 million square foot was that transaction. The landscape is... There's really, honestly, it's great because it's a lot like storage where there's consolidation up at the top end, but there's a ton of mom and pop owners. Like it's vast majority, I would say probably 80% of the product is owned by individual, not private equity or not REIT investors. At least that's my perspective. I could be, you know, I'm open to be, have my mind changed on that.
Probably makes sense though, giving what we kind of talked about earlier, right? So in the terms of why people develop the space they develop, who they develop, because this is a smaller midsize, probably not nearly as much as that institutional side.
There's no brand awareness in small bay industrial. Like nobody's going out and saying, there's really no brand awareness because you don't need an SEO strategy to capture consumers on a monthly turnover basis. You have tenants that you're really just advertising to businesses. It's not B2C at all. So your brand is like a little bit less, necessary in my opinion.
No, that makes perfect sense. There's a lot of really good things about that, obviously. You know, because I mean, it's in storage. If I'm looking at the pros and cons, right, in general, the pros and cons are a little vice versa in the sense. So in storage, pro being that you can build a brand, get new tenants up, right? That is a pro that you don't have to have that in light bay. The con then would also be in storage. The con of that is the reason why that's a pro over here. So they're inverse. So the con of that is we have more work in storage. You have to have a brand, you have to do SEO, you have to bring people in, right? Everything else. Now, the upside is that maybe we can do more value add in it, but then the con to storage is now a pro in your space, meaning you don't have to do all of those things, right? And then maybe the con on that side would be the value add may be more like as far as like time goes and everything, like you were saying, it's leases. So after the this point, there may not be a continual need. So it's an offset. And that's, I think, the thing that I find so interesting. And we have a facility that we have all these bays and we also have a storage on the side of it, right? And it's split probably, let me think here, 50, 60,000 square feet, small bay, then storage is another 100,000 square feet. But the workloads are not comparable. Right. They're not even remotely comparable. Storage is much more where, you know, it tests everything else where it's rare that we actually even have a bay that needs to be filled up. And so you can set it up, and you're right, that value really comes on the acquisition, which that's true, I think, in both aspects. But the way you go about it is different. Even though it is still space and generally used in the same way, one's businesses, one's customers, that's the fundamental difference here, if I'm understanding it.
Yeah.
So what are you trying to do with this then? Like, what is your plan? It's not a brand. So walk us through then your business plan, your strategy.
Yeah, our strategy is that we want to acquire this year, we want to acquire 200,000 square feet of small bay in Southwest Florida. That's this year. Probably looking at in like 4 to 5 years where we want to exit all of these projects in Southwest Florida. And then at that point in time, we'll probably just look at the next asset class that has crazy high demand and not a lot of competition, has been undersupplied and underbuilt, and we'll go into that one. Now, how we go about that is that we have a pretty good, I think we have a pretty good system around it, and I'm pretty excited about it. Basically, you can't go out and purchase. You can go to like CoStar and purchase a list or download a list of small bay facilities. But what you're going to find is that the list is pretty trash because there's no small bay definition product in every given county in Southwest Florida. There's a different definition for the county. So you're not getting the exact product that you want. And what you want is something that's 1,500 square feet, max maybe 5,000 square feet. It's 20-foot high ceilings, 12-foot high doors, has a bathroom, has an office. You can rent that all day long at very high prices. But what you're going to get with these downloaded lists, are you're going to get a massive facility that's 150,000 square feet just because you're downloading an industrial list. And even if you try to nail down the flex space list on CoStar, it's just not honed, let's say. So, which is good. Because if you've put a body on it, a VA, go through, manually scrape the whole territory, create your own list, that's a higher barrier to entry for people sending out mailers, doing marketing directly to owners, etc. So what we do is we manually scrape the entire map for this stuff. Then we send, just like everybody else, send mail, send text, emails, call, etc., broker relationships. What our typical buy box in the area is that we're looking for Lee County. We really want to buy stuff as close to $100 a foot as possible. In Charlotte, maybe a little bit less. And then down in Collier County, it's crazy, but it's like basically double the price down in Naples just because of how much money is down in Naples. Those are the general vicinity buy boxes that we do. Now, where is the power in all this is back again to the first thing that we talked about is demand. So if you have a deal that's $100 a square foot, you need to be able to place tenants. And in order to place tenants in an economical fashion, we've found, you want to source the tenant yourself. Brokers are great. They will bring you tenants, but you got to pay the broker, and you typically have to pay the broker 6% of the value of the entire lease. So you're looking at a check that's probably $12,000 to $20,000 per lease in these markets. So what we do is a ton of marketing to our tenants. So we have a roster of tenants. As soon as we get a property, we can fill that property with our roster of tenants. How do we get those tenants? Well, you do a whole bunch of we operate in that area, so we just have built this list, but how do you build the list? One, you're going on Google, you're finding out, you're just downloading all of the businesses that you want as tenants. So, hey, I don't want automotive guys. I want HVAC guys. I want a plumber. I want electrical supply companies. You're putting all these guys into your database. And then you're creating little basically like Adobe landing pages and sending out your spaces as soon as you have them available directly to these guys' cell phones. Maybe their emails, if you've captured their emails. We haven't really figured out how to capture the emails from a scrape yet, but we've definitely gotten skip trace them and get directly to their cell phones. So that's our system for A, finding, and then B, filling the spaces.
I like it. Now, walk me through though. So you're talking about South Florida a lot. Why is it just growth rates, and how does that compare to, let's say, other markets that have growth rates like that, like Texas, for example?
I don't really have a why not anywhere else. I think the only why not anywhere else is just purely because of bandwidth on our side. Like, we just haven't scaled up. I think that this probably works. My partner and I were in a mastermind with about this product specifically, and there are people there that are doing this all over the country. And they're all having great success with it.
So it's not like you're like, oh, those markets are bad, we don't like them, anything like that. It's, this is our target area, we're going through this, which I assumed it was for a few reasons, meaning there's demand, things like that. But I also, the concentration and ability. So the counties that you just mentioned, right? Like there's so much there in such a little geographic area that you obviously have a good runway, stable markets, they're growing, and product to buy.
Yeah, think about it like this. So who is your, like the we've been hammering this demand thing. Southwest Florida is great because the demand's off the charts. Why? Because obviously population growth rate, people need home services businesses. Who are our tenants? A lot of them are home services businesses, HVAC companies, plumbers, electrical supply. Those are core tenant bases to us, and automotive as well. So with more people comes more demand for space at the end of the day. And this space just really hasn't been built up all that much. So if you can acquire it at, you know, $100 a foot, I mean, I'll lease it up in 3 or 4 weeks. It's not difficult to do. But you need that pipeline. You need all of that. You need to build a list. That's what it comes down to, being able to fill the space.
It is an interesting thing when we talk about markets, because this was one of my actual big things with this asset class. When I looked at storage, there's a lot more markets that I'm concerned about, right? So there's a lot more markets that I'm like, no, it could be really oversaturated, things like that. When I looked at that product type, I'm like, actually, there's most markets that I see are fairly underserved. And it's, if you can get the product and things, I was shocked at the ability, right, of the asset to have high demand over such large swath geographic areas. There was markets that I may have looked at and was like, all right, it's not the greatest, but there's no markets that I was like, really, no, this would be problematic. As opposed to storage, no, there's clearly markets that are problematic that I'm actually concerned in and would not touch at all. Where I didn't really see that in this asset class. And is there areas though that you know of and you would say, I don't like it, and then why?
Yeah. So number one, it's coming to small bay. The same problem is coming to small bay. The only reason why it's not here yet is because everyone's, you know, found another sexy asset where they were developing. It's just the development cycle has just not hit small bay as hard as it hit. Or I guess I said as much as it hit self-storage. But it's coming for sure. It is a higher dollar per foot to build than storage is, because you have plumbing, et cetera, higher ceilings. It's more expensive to build. Are there areas that I wouldn't touch? Yeah, there's parts of Fort Myers where it's getting built up pretty hefty right now. So, but again, it's a question of basis. So these guys are building, they're putting this stuff on the market for, I got to imagine, again, I haven't done any development, but I got to imagine it's every bit of probably $140, $160 a foot to put this stuff up. So if you're buying it at $160 a foot and it's old product, yeah, I'd be worried. I would not do that. But if you're buying stuff at $100 a foot, I'm totally fine doing that and competing with those guys because my basis is way lower and I can endure more pain.
So that's one of the big things you look at, is replacement cost when entering into a market.
Yes. Yes.
What are the other metrics that you look at? How do you quantify demand?
Yeah. So what we do when we get a property under contract is we will put out ads for that. Now, again, we operate in some pretty tight areas. So we'll hit up our tenant list and say, hey, product coming soon. And we'll just see how much demand that we get, how many responses we get into, you know, for that individual product type. Smaller product type rents way faster than bigger product type. Super hard. It's when I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, I can lease something in 3 to 4 weeks. Any day, you can do that within probably a week if it's a 1,000 square foot unit. But it's going to take you probably 2 to 3 months if it's a 5,000 square foot unit. At least in those markets. I forgot the question. Sorry.
No. So like, when you're looking at these markets and you're trying to quantify demand, how do you quantify it?
Yeah. So number one, we'll hit up our list with the product coming soon. We'll create an Adobe page and it'll just be like a landing page for the property. That landing page for the property, it'll have photos, etc. We'll gauge how much response we get back from that. If within the first 2 to 3 days, if we get something like 15 to 20 responses, we know that there's demand there for that product. What else we'll do? We'll put it up on Crexie. If the broker will let us put it up on Crexie for listing, you know, you try to get, if it is a brokered deal. If it's a direct deal, it's usually not an issue. So a couple of avenues, just put it online, see what the demand is, and then hit up your tenant list that you've already curated and see what the demand is.
Got it. Market testing. I love that. Like a traditional market, we're going to go in. Let's literally just go talk to the customers. That's amazing. Because storage, we don't have that. The reason being is people are like, well, I could ask. Yeah, but it's an on-demand product. So if you asked somebody, hey, do you want to rent a storage facility? They may go, no. 3 weeks later, they may go, actually, I need to now. It's not something they plan. It's not like, I'm so excited. I've been looking for my storage unit for 6 months. That doesn't happen. So that is we can't test markets like that, which is actually, that makes it really hard. So if you're going to go into a storage market and you're like, all right, I want to build 100,000 square feet. Is there demand? We can look at occupancy and we can look at rates, but that doesn't necessarily translate into exact demand. So meaning that you can have facilities that are 90% full. That doesn't mean that you can build 100,000 square feet and there's 100,000 square feet of demand in that market. That's not how it works, right? So what we have to do is say, all right, how much demand it means excess storage facility, and maybe have a range. So if there's 400,000 square feet of storage, or you have 90% occupancy and you want to add 100,000 square feet, can you get is there one fourth demand more in that market? That's questionable. Now, if you have 2 million square feet or 3 million square feet in the market at 90% full, and you're building 100,000 square feet, and you look at the individual unit types, you get a way better picture, because that would be if you had 2 million square feet, you're putting 100,000. That's 5%. That's only 5% supply on the market, right? And so that's how we have to look at it. But still, that's a pretty big guess. But if I have 20 bays and I put it on and I have 15 people in the first month reach out to rent, I already know. It's like I can see it. And then I can call my buyers list, right? So I really like that a lot, because I know I'm asking my customers, I'm getting my customers, and then I'm supplying them with the product. That's one of my things that why I didn't develop storage for so long was because I'm like, it was so hard for me to quantify and feel comfortable with that, because I couldn't create. If I did a business, I'm going to create a product and I'm going to do market testing. Take it out. People buy it. I'm like, okay, there's demand, right? So I love that you can do that in a real estate product. You can literally do market demand and bring it and see if your customers want it. That's awesome.
When you guys are looking at property management software for your storage facilities, there's a ton of options out there, but no other option compares to Tenant Inc. Tenant Inc. is going to be your one-stop shop solution that has an amazing amount of tools that you can deploy at your fingertips to maximize the value of your facility, to operate it more efficiently, more effectively. They have an open API where you can back in almost anything you want. You own your data, and it's just an incredible solution. I can't say enough good things about these guys. Link is in the show notes. Be sure to check out Tenant Inc.
Now, walk me through what your traditional size looks like. How many bays? What are the size of those bays? And what do you find in markets? Like 5,000 square feet, 100,000 square feet? Like, where is that demand and how's that work as far as size and doors per property?
Yeah. So let's say standard property will be 20 to 30,000 square feet. On that 20 to 30,000 square feet, that's obviously, let's compare it against a storage facility. Storage facility, you probably want 40,000 square feet and above to get your NOI, you know, let's call it a 400 to half a million bucks. These are a lot less operationally intensive. So you don't have a lot of the costs that you do with storage, aka spare foot or something like that. So you can go a little bit down market. We like those deals because you can transact in them. The financing is actually like pretty easy. You can often get owner financing. That's what we found. I'm sure we'll scale up from here. But let's just take the deals that we've been working on lately. 30,000 square feet. That one has 11 doors in particular, has the ability to subdivide and has rough-ins, meaning electrical rough-ins, plumbing rough-ins, to subdivide into 30 units. But it's set up as 11 units currently. The spaces, what I would advise, if you could find a property that is being able to be subdivided into 1,000 square foot bays, your probability of success is very, very, very high, and you're going to get the most amount of money out of that property as you can, just like you would a 5x5 versus renting a 20x30.
Your revenue per square foot is higher.
Totally. And the demand for those, and the reason why is because the demand for those units is way higher, because you have people that are transitioning from working out of their house, their garage, whatever, and they are, you know, they've been a couple years in business, so their cash in the bank is there. They have good credit, but they need a bit of place to have a actual hang a business license. And so there's a lot of, you know, transient tenants. They'll occupy the space for 3 years and then move into another space. And that's why this current property that I was mentioning, it's set up for 30 units, but it only has 11. Why? Because customers, they rented 1,000 square foot and then they just broke down another wall, rented the unit right next to them and the unit right next to them. And that's how it ended up growing from there, just because that's the nature of everybody's small business. They grow if they're successful. So those are typically what a property looks like. Now, you'll get into sizes that are 5,000 square feet up 10, 20,000 square feet. Those are harder to lease, for sure. Harder to lease. You're most likely, the larger the space that you're going to go into, the more often you're going to need a broker for those deals. Otherwise, you're going to have to get really good at prospecting into companies that have a serious balance sheet. Companies, think about like the rent on a, if it's 10 bucks triple net a foot and they're renting 20,000 square feet, you know, you're looking at 20 grand a month on that. So the business probably should be generating like, I don't know, $3 to $4 million in top line revenue in order to afford a rental payment like that. So it's a legit business. The only way that you're going to get in front of those legit businesses is that they're going to have gatekeepers. So you need to be better prospecting, and the brokers, they prospect all day long. So you're going to need most likely a broker to lease those larger spaces.
Got it. That makes perfect sense. It goes back to kind of what I think I was talking about before, where people kind of, they didn't develop these smaller stuff. That's not something they did. They went for a much bigger contract, Amazon, right? That's how everybody thought. And there just wasn't. If you wanted, you know, 1,000 square feet, and even you wanted, let's say, you know, 3,000 square foot, have an office kind of space anywhere you can work out of, that is hard to find.
Yeah.
And yet with the internet, what happened was we fractionalized workforce and we made, let's take a business, for example. And I think this is important for people to understand. Business used to be all of the pieces together and there was no way to fractionalize it. Meaning that your specialist within the business, they were all part of a bigger process and they all came together to create that output. And there was no, like, but when the internet came, all of a sudden you could take a specialist within a business could leave and be a specialist now for that business and two others. All of a sudden they could be a specialist and create their own business out of being a specialist, manage, market, because you could take the process here and you could attach yourself to a process via the internet. Where before, how'd you do that, right? No, the process had to be within the business. Now, this also happened with products. So before, if you couldn't get into Walmart, you couldn't sell a product. Well, all of a sudden now, you've fractionalized retail. And you can be a specialist, and I don't need to provide, you know, a million units to Walmart. No, I can sell 10,000 units and have a business out of that now. That didn't exist prior to really the 2000s. I mean, and so all of a sudden, you didn't have infrastructure for this kind of stuff because there was no need for it. Then you had the Great Recession, and that need too, I think, was very looked down. But most importantly, the allocation of mass capital, institutional, that didn't make sense. Well, wait, we're going to have 11 units, and what is the cost going to be? It's the same thing that hit the problem with storage, right? So it created such an interesting environment for this product type that I love so much because I believe the demand, right? I've seen it. I understand it. I own small businesses that need flex space, that need that, but they don't need big. And there really hasn't ever been a wave of infrastructure within the United States to support that part of the economy. And that's what you're doing. You're playing off that part of the economy, which is a growing piece, not a shrinking piece. It's expanding rapidly, in fact.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. A lot of our tenants that we have are, there are e-commerce companies. There's home services companies, like I had mentioned before, but a lot of them, they are e-commerce companies. They just need a place. They need an office where they can do paperwork out of, but they need a warehouse where they can ship their product out of. And it's not e-commerce companies that are, you know, super, super large. They're consuming 3,000 square feet and they're doing just fine.
And two, a lot of these guys, they're doing it out of their home and still are. There's so many people that are running e-commerce companies out of their home, which with the advent of HOAs, regulations, city regulations, you can't do that anymore. So now they have to. So the same thing that happened with storage, regulation and economic trends created demand for self-storage. A lot of people think it's because we're hoarders. That is, of course, true. But that isn't actually the major driving reason why we can support 11% of the population utilizing storage. It's because you can't do it these things out of your home. You can't do it on the street. You can't do that. This is one of the same driving thing. 85% of all developments have HOA today. 85% of all housing developments have HOAs. HOAs do not allow you to run businesses out of your home. That's against the rules. So what you used to be able to do, you can't even do it today. It doesn't exist. So tell me about your view on now. You mentioned you're doing like a true roll-up model, though, like, right? Because you'll go into other industries, other asset classes. So more on away from this asset class, tell me about the business you're trying to build.
Yeah, so the business that we're trying to build is really around small bay at the moment and storage at the moment. So we operate storage facilities and then we operate small bay. We want to have a foot in both worlds. Why? Because it's one's B2B and one's B2C. And we think that they have different, they operate a little bit differently, but pretty much the same where we don't need different skill sets and different people to run them. They're just a little bit different on the expense load and a little bit different on the day-to-day, but the operating company is pretty much the same and we use the same bodies. Now, from there, why we like storage and a mix of, small bay is because one, we can treat much more so like a business where we are in it every day. We can tweak things. We can improve revenue, just like we were talking about at the beginning of the podcast with revenue management, implement those systems. We can see it working its way, the P&L working its way up. And then on this side, the small bay side, we can kind of have a, I don't want to make it seem like it's a set it and forget it asset, but it's much more of a, once it's done, you just burn down the lease for 2-3 years and then you put another effort into it. Okay. So from a strategy perspective, that's why we're in both worlds. Long term, we want to own and operate these, but then we do want to exit them, within 5 years. From there, we'll take profits. I'm sure we'll live off of some, but I don't really want to live off all the profits. I'd prefer to just trade them into another deal. Now, whether that's, you know, buying decrepit malls in 5 years and figuring out how to convert those into small bay and maybe some storage and maybe, you know, keep some retail. That may be something down the line, or it could be, I don't know what. But the business is basically, we're super opportunistic and we see the opportunity at the current moment in small bay and obviously in storage, but we will exit both of those within the next 5 years.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. I love it. And then you just keep rolling it and moving it forward and building it out. That's amazing. All right, dude, what else are you trying, like, so You have this great view of this market. I love your market you're in. I love what you're building. I love how you're allocating your capital, the thesis alone for it. I think that people can see, first of all, the economic drivers, the similarities between the two, the differences between the two, and actually how I've been talking about, and like you're talking about, they work together really well. Customer, right? Business, long-term lease, short-term lease. You still get the spreads, the way it's worked out. Demand, height, like they fit together well. That's why I have them. That's why you have them. That's why we both do both, right? So I do storage. I have it. But you're an expert in that spot way more than I am. I got into it because I liked it, but it came along with storage. I wasn't independently going out and getting it, right? And that's how I got into it, even though I've been talking for 3 years. Like, I love it. I want to get into it, right? Everything else. But I just didn't have the infrastructure where you've built that out and you've become an expertise in that, right? What else should everybody listen to the podcast? What should they know about? What should they know about the opportunities or anything that you can think of off the top of your head that's like, hey, before we end, I want to get these points across.
Yeah. Let's think about it. So I think whatever, I know we've hit on it a lot, but I think whatever industry you want to go into, whatever product, real estate asset class you go into, it all comes down to how fast you can lease something up at a given rate that is profitable for you. So I would say if somebody's considering small bay, look at how much you can lease the property for relative to how much your price per foot is on your acquisition. And if it's above a 10 cap, I'd probably do the deal.
Above a 10 cap, so at the purchase price. It's funny.
Yeah, so let's talk about the math there, just because I've said that a couple of times and I haven't explained the math on that. All right, so if I buy it at $100 a foot and I can rent it triple net rents at $10 a foot, that is a 10 cap. Okay, so if I can go, just taking that principle, if your market is $120 a foot for acquisition, or if it's $80, use your net rent, your NOI or your triple net rent, as your base, as your analysis tool, and it's a lot easier to quickly analyze a deal. So that's the math behind what I've mentioned a couple of times.
So this is important because so yesterday I had to get done with my manuscript with my book, which dude was ridiculous. The last like 2.5 weeks, I haven't slept because it's 400 plus pages. It's ridiculous, so over the top. But I was with the editors yesterday. I gave them the final manuscripts and everything. They're like, "Well, we got this question. We're confused by because in your charts, you're saying you buy it at a 6 cap, right? And then you own it, and then it's worth 8 cap, right?" And they go, "But you also said that properties are more valuable the lower the cap rate is. So then why does the cap rate go up? That means value went down." And I'm like, no, let me explain. It's funny, they didn't understand it to the point where I'm like, take it out. We're just gonna do yield on cost because it was so confusing. And what we're implying here, that's the only reason I bring it up, because I didn't realize that that was confusing. It's as if you bought it at a 10 cap. So that changed the value that you purchased, which was a 6 cap, which meant you paid a high amount. So, or generally speaking, it means that was the value. All of a sudden, the price that you bought it at is now a 10 cap, which means it's as if you paid less. So that equity portion is growing because your income's growing. So that's a good thing. It's not like he's going to sell it at a 10 cap. No, he would sell it at a 6 cap. It's just, it's as if then he bought it for a 10 cap, that spread. Want to make sure that's clear so nobody gets confused on that.
Yeah. Talk about CapEx on, cap rate on basis.
Basis. Exactly.
Yep. If I'm all into the property for $100, I want to be able to rent it out for $10 a foot triple net. Gets me a 10 cap on my basis.
It's amazing. If you could go out and buy 10 caps, you're getting a 10% return without debt or anything else like that on the money that you're putting on. You would do that all day long. And if you can buy something at a 10 cap and sell it at a 6 cap, holy cow, that is a money-making machine. That is like, you know, that is, that's like the equivalent of turning lead into gold. Like, you know, and so that's what you're describing right there.
Yeah. Granted, this product does not trade at 6 caps. Unless it's a large portfolio, okay? So be very clear with everybody. This product has not seen the cap rate compression that self-storage has in Class A facilities in, you know, great markets. Okay, so let's take a market where cap rate basically doesn't even exist. It's Naples, Florida. Okay, so people will pay a 3 cap in Naples, Florida. Why? Because it's all 1031 money. Everybody's moving there from the Midwest who's retired and they have $10 million. It's all the business owners that are
exactly. There. They're just buying it to own.
They're buying it to avoid taxes. That's all they're doing.
All they're doing. That is the return they get. They don't care about necessarily. Exactly.
You got to look at, you know, other markets. It doesn't operate like that. In, for example, 30 miles away in Fort Myers, you're going to see this stuff for a 30,000 square foot facility on the open market listed by a broker where you're still going to have, you know, it's going to be competitive, but it's probably going to trade for a 7 cap right now, maybe a 7.5 cap. So it's not as, I would say it's not as compressed on the cap rates as self-storage is at the moment.
And that's purely, guys, remember when we talk about cap rates, it's an expression that we're purchasing on extrinsic value, meaning the buyers and the sellers come together. So if you're buying something at a 5 cap and it's worth $1 million, you would make 50,000. Now, if you buy it for a 10 cap, it would either make $100,000 or it would have to come down to a purchase price of $500,000 to get you that 10% return. That's why this is so powerful. That's why we're talking about it. Meaning this, if he bought something for, and I'm using simple numbers here, I'm not saying you're actually doing this. If you were, I'm selling everything and giving you all my money. But if you're going out to the market, right, and he's buying something that he can make into a 10 cap, which would be he's making $100,000 on a million, and then he's selling it for a 5 cap, that would mean it went to $2 million. So that is that spread or that value. When we're talking about cap rates, it's an expression of the return you get. You can either change the income, which means you're making a higher return because the income is, or what you pay for it. I know it can sound complicated, everybody. It's actually not that complicated. Just think of a cap rate as an expression of a return that you get. Returns change by what you pay or the income you make. That's all. We have a whole YouTube video, by the way, on go check it out because I don't want anybody to be confused by it.
Yeah. I would say another takeaway, you asked about takeaways that, you know, I think people should have about small bay. Don't go into it without somebody who's done it before. Why? I'll tell you exactly why I ran into this problem. In Fort Myers, at one of the facilities that we have, you need remember I said at the beginning of a lease, it's a lot of handholding. It's a lot more, let's just say a lot of effort from the landlord side of things. Okay, you place a tenant, that tenant, in order for you not to get a code violation, and then you would owe fines, and then obviously your property's encumbered by some point on title, you need to have a certificate of occupancy for that business. In order to get a certificate of occupancy, you got to pass fire inspections, building inspections, electrical inspections. So the county is much more involved in your property than you would have in self-storage. So at every tenant turnover, you're going to need an inspection from your county or your zoning, your building department when you get your certificate of occupancy. So go in eyes wide open on that, because you can get into a pretty hairy situation if the previous owner made a whole bunch of improvements that were not permitted. The guys come, you sold a product to your tenant that was, hey, we have a mezzanine floor. It's got railings and everything. You know, use it for storage. Use it for whatever. City comes in. They're like, no. That was not permitted. So during your inspection period, make sure you're being diligent in looking through whatever is on the old permits, what is not on the old permits, importantly, and then what your current zoning is. If you're not allowed for a certain use, that can really chap you if you place a tenant in there. And they do some, let's say they do a little bit of build out, and then the city comes back and says, hey, you know, this use isn't allowed when they went for their occupancy permit, you know, tough buckets, you know, they gotta move out. And then they're coming after you saying, it's just, that's not a situation that I would want any of the people here being in, because that's an opportunity for everybody to lose money. So go eyes wide open on that due diligence item for sure.
100%. It, like everything, you know, the largest risk you have is knowledge. So what you don't know, what you don't know, right? That's the risk. And this is why in storage, obviously, we have our educational, right? You're in my mastermind. It's why we do feasibility studies. Because when I started out, why we wouldn't buy something, it was actually because we just didn't know what we didn't know. And so we're like, I don't know, there may be risk here, there may not be. And so what you do in working with other people and helping and getting other people that know, or partnering, which we do a lot of, we have Store Local, right? That is what you're trying to bridge. You're trying to get over that. It's why those partnerships are important. It's why those things like feasibility studies, you're like, what am I missing here? The most danger you're ever in is that you think that you're not. So even with like all our resources and knowledge, we still do feasibility studies because we just want to know, what am I missing that I'm not? And that's a perfect example why you shouldn't just go at it alone and think, oh, I'm going to make it work because you don't know what you don't know. And that's okay. That's why I love commercial real estate. We partner, we do things with others, and it still works. Dude, okay, this isn't an awesome discussion. We're already over an hour. This is so intriguing to me. I love it. I can't wait to see what you're doing. Where can people find out more about you? Where should we send people? Where can they reach out?
Yeah. So you can reach out to me on LinkedIn. It's Shea Lewis. Just pop me a message on LinkedIn. My email is Shea, S-H-E-A, at zequitygroup.com. You can also find us at our website, zequitygroup.com. If anybody's in Southwest Florida and you find deals that small bay deals that are about $100 a foot, let's do a deal. We know how to lease them up extremely fast. And we can turn them, and cash flow is very, very healthy. So $100 a foot is generally the kind of the bar. And we want deals that are above 20,000 square feet.
Awesome. Everybody reach out, and buddy, it's good seeing you, man. Appreciate you coming on. I'm glad you agreed to it.